Pye, welcome to another episode of the Room and Room podcasts. Just introducing myself, my name's Charlotte Westwood. I'm a vet and nutritionist based with the PGG Lights and Seeds team at Kimmehere Research Centre here in Canterbury in New Zealand. So look, in this, our latest episode, we're going to be exploring the basics around the measure of energy in feeds, and that's reported commonly here in New Zealand as megajoules of metabolizable energy in a kilo of dry matter. And this is as it relates to just to the ruminant species. So that'll be cattle and sheep and deer. Now, many of you will probably be taking a deep breath at this stage and going, oh my goodness, Charlotte, this is going to be such a dry, boring subject. And if I was you, I'd be thinking exactly the same thing. That said, I promise that we'll try and make this megajoules of metabolizable energy subject for this podcast as easy to digest as possible, if you forgive the pun on that one. So anyway, let's get this megajoules of metabolizable energy content of our podcast underway. Now, first things first, I don't know about you, but there's no way that I'm going to keep saying that megajoules of metabolizable energy over and over again. So look, if it's all right with you, I'm going to shorten that up for the rest of the podcast to the much easier to say megajoules of ME, or just plain old ME, in place of saying megajoules of metabolizable energy. So enough about that. Now, I'm just kind of thinking through here, what's going to be the easiest way to digest this ME topic? Look, I reckon what we'll do, we'll kind of split that in two. First of all, we're going to start off by defining ME at a conceptual level around what is energy, and then we'll move on to more about the definition of megajoules of ME. Then, I guess, for the rest of this podcast, what we'll do is we'll move on to ME itself and kind of, based on how ruminants digest their feed, try to understand where metabolizable energy starts from. And again, it actually starts as gross energy, and then I'll step you through kind of step by step how we end up with metabolizable energy based on what's happening largely at the level of the rumen. We'll also talk about how we can measure ME, well, not us, but how those clever people in the feed testing labs and the scientists and universities can measure it. Or if we can't measure it exactly, how, and more commonly this is the way, we can calculate an estimate of what the ME of a feed is likely to be. And then after that, we'll kind of look into some of the strengths and weaknesses or limitations of ME as a measure of energy density of ruminant feeds. And then we'll finish up with some of the practical ways we can apply ME at a farm level. And I guess that's the gumboot equivalent of what we do on farm. Let's get this latest podcast underway. You guys know the drill by now. If you're in the kitchen or you put the jug on at the dairy shed or a wool shed, grab a cuppa and sit down and put your feet up, or more likely if you're out on the road or in the tractor or wherever, just hope that this latest podcast helps pass the day of chores well for you. Righto, first up, as we mentioned, just what is metabolizable energy? Well, I guess we'll back the proverbial bus up a little bit further first and say, what's energy itself? You know, like a 101 introduction to energy. So just like us, our sheep or our dairy cows, our beefies, deer, obviously need energy just to survive on a day-to-day basis. Now, probably just like you, I find the chemistry of energy rather boring. It's kind of, I seem to remember second year vet school learning biochemistry and then promptly forgetting it just to get through exams. But look, we will acknowledge the much cleverer academics out there. They've figured out it's all to do with what they call ATP. That's kind of the central part of energy, because at the cellular level, inside muscle cells and bone cells and heart cells and everything else, ATP is what the cells use to function. And that's not only for an animal to survive, but obviously secretory cells in the udder of lactating animals, they need ATP to do their thing, to manufacture the components of milk. So on a day-to-day basis, we do need ATP. And where do the animals get ATP, the energy at the cellular level, from? Well, this is where we step back into good old ruminant nutrition, and it's from the digestion of carbohydrates, proteins, and fats that they eat on a day-to-day basis in pasture or total mix rations or whatever. And then you'll go, oh, Charlotte, this is getting a bit deep and awful. Hang on. What does MJME, megajoules, have to do with ATP at a cellular level? Well, here we have feeds with a higher ME value will overall generate and provide more ATP at the cellular levels for your cows, your beefies, your lambs, your ewes, and all of those animals on farm. More energy-dense feed means more ATP for the cells to do useful things. So happier energy-fueled cells throughout an animal's body means that they'll have more energy to walk and graze more efficiently. They'll be more tolerant of particularly of hot conditions, because that requires a lot of energy to respire all that heat out. If they're young and growing animals, higher ME and more ATP means they're going to grow more quickly. Growing a pregnancy inside mum's tum, more energy for that. And as I said before, lactating or growing wool, not that wool's worth it, not much, a lot much at the moment, or the coarse wool. Just whatever we're doing on farm with our animals, more ME means better animal performance. So right, disclaimer, that's the end about chemistry and ATP and the like. We'll leave that for the academics. Let's move more onto the concept of ME itself. Let's explore megajoules of metabolizable energy itself, and let's split megajoules of metabolizable energy in two. Let's first talk about megajoules, what they are, and then the term metabolizable energy itself. So two bites of megajoules of metabolizable energy. First up, the megajoules part. What the hell is that? Well, if you Google joule, so J-O-U-L-E, it's simply the measure, the unit of energy that's used internationally across all aspects of energy, not by in any ways limited to the nutritional side of things. So that's joule, the unit of energy. What about the mega? Well, just like megabytes of data, megalitres of water if you're irrigating in Australia. All it means is that for every one megajoule, that's 1 million joules. So mega is a million. And be thankful that someone started calling it megajoules. Otherwise, every time we talked about in every 1 kilo dry matter of pasture, it contains 12 million joules of ME per kilogram of dry matter. So thank goodness we're just talking about megajoules. Mega, 1 million. And before we leave the topic of the megajoules part of ME behind, for sure, unashamedly, we are a New Zealand-based podcast. And locally here in New Zealand, we tend to only use megajoules as a metric that we use for discussing energy. But acknowledging for our ever-growing international audience, and we love the fact that we've got people tuning in from all over the world to this podcast, we're of course just acknowledging that ME can also, as well as being defined as megajoules, it can be defined as megacalories. That's 1 million calories per kilogram of dry matter, or commonly in America, per pound of dry matter. So defining megacalories, that's 1 million calories, and it's just a different way of defining energy. Now, given Google has turned us all really into a global village, you can pretty well Google references from anywhere around the world now. If you do pick up a reference and it's describing, let's say, 2.5 megacalories per kilogram of dry matter, and you're based here in New Zealand with us and you're saying, what's that in megajoules? Obviously, there's lots of conversion calculators online, but quick and simple with the calculator on your phone. If you multiply megacalories per kilogram of dry matter by 4.18, then that will very quickly convert your megacalories to megajoules of metabolizable energy. Too easy, eh? And of course, the other way around, to convert megajoules of ME back to megacals of ME, you obviously divide it by 4.18. And if you can't remember that, there obviously are the calculators online. So that's the megajoule or megacal part of the term of megajoules of metabolizable energy. What about the second part? What does metabolizable energy mean? Well, essentially, it's just energy that is usable. It actually can be used by our ruminants to grow, to allow the animal to walk, to provide support for lactation. It's a usable part of energy in the feed. So if we kind of break this down a little bit further, well, normally if we were sitting around a table together or whatever, we'd get the crayons out, you know, you get a pen out and kind of draw a bit of a flow diagram for us. So to try and show more easily what metabolizable energy is. So let's just pretend we've got a visual flow diagram, if you'd like, so you can picture this. Up the top of the flow diagram on a whiteboard or a sketchy bit of paper, we're going to start with the term what's called gross energy. And then we're going to flow down the whiteboard showing step by step where losses of energy occur during digestion, and therefore we lose energy from the system for the animal so it can no longer use it. And then the bottom of the whiteboard, we're going to end up with a metabolizable energy, which, as we said, simply means energy that the animal can actually use for useful stuff on a day-to-day basis, not only to stay alive, but whether you're milking cows or finishing lambs, that they're actually doing something that can then provide your animal with something that you can sell. But anyway, let's kick off the gross energy first. So that's up the top of this visual whiteboard in your mind. Well, first up, let's define gross energy. Well, first up, it's not like gross, ooh, yuck, disgusting energy. Gross energy simply means the absolute amount of energy in a feed, but acknowledging not all of that gross energy can be used by your cows or your lambs you're finishing or your deer. That's gross energy. Every single megajoule of energy, but it's not all used by the animal. Now, as far as how do these clever scientists figure out how much gross energy is in a feed? Well, in a very blunt, simplistic sense, all they do is grind up 1 kilo of dry matter of a feed and place it inside what is called a bomb calorimeter. And yeah, sounds a bit scary, the old bomb, but what they do is they combust or burn that feed until there's nothing left at all, just a bit of ash in the bottom. And they measure the heat in joules, the unit of energy, that is yielded from when you completely combust that feed. So that's gross energy. Now, if we look at feeds of plant-based origin, let's think pasture, ensiled feeds, lucerne, chicory, plantain, the gross energy of these feeds usually sits somewhere between 18 and 19 megajoules of gross energy per kilogram of dry matter. Now, why on earth with forages is the gross energy sitting around about that 18 or 19 megajoules of gross energy? Well, look, it's because the energy is coming from the different components of the pasture, from fibre, from sugars, from starches, protein and oil, for example, plus ash, which is the ash measure you see on feed tests and that's left in the bottom of the combusted bomb calorimeter, is just your minerals largely. Now, each of those components, fibre, sugars, starch, protein, oils or fats, each have their own different gross energies. So, for example, if we combusted just 1 kilo of fat, just like when we eat a very fatty food, we've probably got to put on weight if we eat it day after day. That's because the gross energy of fat or oils is round about 40 megajoules of gross energy per kilogram of dry matter. On the other hand, proteins and feeds have a gross energy of more like 24 megajoules of gross energy per kilogram dry matter. The starch in your cereal grains or your byproducts like tapioca, the gross energy is around 18 megajoules of gross energy per kilogram dry matter. And then there's ash. Well, ash is just ash. So if we burn a kilo of ash, it's not going to burn, right? So the gross energy of ash is actually zero, because if you burn it, you get no more heat because it's already combusted. So the driver of gross energy in our feeds is driven by the ratio of all of those different nutrients in your animal's feed. But as we say, for our common forages here in New Zealand, we on average start up the top of the whiteboard of a starting gross energy value of 18 to 19 megajoules of gross energy per kilogram dry matter. Now, I suspect you're thinking, that's a big number. You know, most of our MEs of pasture might be, I don't know, you know, 9 to 12 or 12 and a half at best. And I bet you're thinking, but your gross energy, Charlotte, you just said is 18 to 19. How cool would it be if our MEs were 18 to 19? Like all of that gross energy could be used. But of course, through the digestive process, that's not the case. And ruminants, pretty well no matter what we feed them, they can't use all of that gross energy, certainly as part of it, a complete diet. And let's go back to that flow diagram. So the crayons are out. We've got gross energy up the front. We're going to draw a line down the page or down the whiteboard, and we're going to define the next level down. So the first loss of potentially utilisable energy from the diet is if, let's say, we have a dairy cow, for example. If she eats 1 kilogram dry matter of perhaps pasture, and that pasture contains 19 megajoules of gross energy, the first major inefficiency that causes energy loss is happening during the digestive process from the mouth to the ruminant and reticulum, and then right through to the large intestine, the rectum, and then out the back end. So as you know, what's not digestible in a diet ends up out the back end as poo or dung onto pasture. So in a simplistic sense, the first loss of energy when we step down that whiteboard or piece of paper from gross energy down is we have that gross energy and we need to subtract energy lost out the back end and back onto pasture. So that gives us the next energy value, arrow down, to what we call digestible energy. And if you think about it, let's think if you were feeding a dairy cow very poor quality pasture, some rubbish quality hay or silage, and in that situation, as little as 35% of gross energy ends up as digestible energy, and 65% ends up passed out the back end as dung, and those dungs will be very firm, they'll look like horse poo, and only 35% worst case ends up as digestible energy, which is the next step in being potentially utilisable by the animal. On the other hand, if that cow has a kilo of very high quality ryegrass white clover pasture, up to 85% of gross energy ends up as digestible energy, with about 15% lost out the back end of a dung. So there's our whiteboard, gross energy up the top. The first loss, even with a very high quality feed, is lost as fecal energy, and what we have left is digestible energy. So here's where our diagram's up now. Now, digestible energy still isn't the same as metabolizable energy, which is obviously where we're trying to steer this discussion to. So the next step in the flow diagram down the page is to account for losses of digestible energy. So that's the energy that's left once we've lost dung out the back end. And that's losses associated with yet more digestive processes. And the main couple of energy losses here is potential feed or the digestible energy that's lost as methane from the rumen and reticulum. And as well as that, we lose energy in the urine, particularly if that's protein energy that's lost out as urinary urea. So there's our flow diagram. We've got gross energy, arrow down to digestible energy. We have an arrow off to one side accounting for energy lost as fecal energy. Now, from digestible energy, the next losses are losses as methane and urine energy. And once we account for losses associated with methane and urinary energy, we're left with, yes, drum roll please, yay, metabolizable energy. So the key thing here, if we just pause at the moment, that the losses of energy as methane, as we follow down the flow diagram from digestible to metabolizable energies, will vary based on different types of feed on farm. Also vary with other things, how much an animal's eating as a percentage of its live weight. There's lots and lots of factors, and that's going to be worthy of another podcast another day, the whole methane issue, what's happening at the level of the rumen, because there's certainly been a lot of interest that we've been finding talking day to day to farmers. So quick look at different types of feeds. Let's say, for example, a diet that contains a lot of starch, perhaps probably more the Australian side of things, where you're feeding a lot more cereal grain to dairy cows on a day-to-day basis than we are in New Zealand. When we feed a lot of cereal grains, that reduces the losses of methane compared to cows eating a diet, say, based on a lot of poor quality silage. So the poorer quality the feed, on average, not always, but on average, will yield more methane per kilogram dry matter eaten compared to a diet that contains excellent quality feeds, particularly those containing starch. So on average, if we just accept that diets vary in their ability to support more or less methane, on average, as we go from digestible energy on our flow diagram down to metabolizable energy, we can lose anything from maybe 14% of digestible energy as methane and urinary energy losses, right through to as much as 19% of digestible energy being lost as methane and urinary energy on the poorer quality feeds. So again, we'll come back to methane another day. That's probably, we'll just park it there now. So as summing up this crayon sketch of energy losses from gross energy to digestible energy and then digestible energy to metabolizable energy, the greatest losses of gross energy through that pathway still is energy lost as fecal energy, so that between gross and digestible energy. So you can account for up to 21 and 31% of gross energy losses being lost as fecal energy. And then the next biggest losses, methane, probably 5 to 8% of gross energy, and probably urinary energy, at the most up to 8% of gross energy. Enough of that. I hope I haven't put you totally to sleep, but I think it's important just to understand that not all energy and feed is available to the animal. So the next discussion point in our current metabolizable energy podcast, how do we know, or how do we define what the ME content of a feed is? Well, the absolute kind of gold standard approach is based on methods using live animals, live ruminants. In most cases, internationally, this is done using sheep. So what the scientists and academics do is they house a number of, usually sheep, inside individual metabolism crates or stalls. And what those scientists do is they weigh out the amount of feed going to each of the sheep, and then they weigh anything that the sheep doesn't eat to know exactly how much energy is going in the front end of that animal. And they're usually fed at maintenance levels. They're not fed enough to grow or do anything else, just at maintenance levels. And what the academics and their clever technicians do is that they measure not only the energy going in the front end of those sheep, but they measure anything that the sheep produces as an output. So that might be as urinary energy. They collect all the urine and find out what the gross energy of the urine is, the feces as well. And they capture and measure methane as well. So when you have the energy content of the feed, the feces, the urine, and accounting for methane as well, they can work out just how much energy is lost as urine, feces, or methane. And anything that's left from the energy that was at the front end of the sheep is assumed to be metabolizable energy. So I bet you're thinking, wow, Charlotte, all of that hard work with sheep and crates, measuring all of the feed in, the methane and feces and urine coming out, doesn't sound very practical, hey, if you want just a sample from your stack of silage to be analysed for ME. And I suspect you probably, well, I wouldn't anyway, probably wouldn't want to pay thousands of bucks to know what the absolutely true ME value of your silage sample or grass sample was. So surely there must be a simpler way. And yes, of course there is. And you'll be fully aware when you've bagged up samples and sent them off that of course there's a simpler, slightly less accurate way, but very valuable. The feed testing labs can do things inside the lab that don't require sheep in crates, just to give us an approximation or the estimate of the megajoules of ME of the feed, to test that more quickly, faster turnaround, and not having to have sheep in crates. So how do they do this? How do the feed testing labs do this for us? First up, you'll note that we're using the term, and you'll heard the term used as well, about calculating the ME of a feed in a laboratory. So it's exactly that. It's a calculation or an estimate versus that true using the sheep that gives us the absolute best measure. So what the feed testing labs do, certainly here in New Zealand anyway, if we look at Hill Laboratories, our largest laboratory, this is what they do. And they look at the digestibility value of your feed. Other labs will sometimes look at other chemical measures of feed, such as the fat content, the lignin content, the amount of acid detergent fibre, NDF, and neutral detergent fibre and the like. And internationally, if you Google it, you'll find a heap of different equations that are used to calculate the ME values of your feeds. Often different equations, some are based on digestibility and some are based on those other measures. So all of those different types of calculations just reiterate the point, I suppose, that ME is a calculated value, not an actual value through feeding sheep and metabolism crates. For, as I say, many of our forage samples processed here, particularly through Hill Laboratories, Hills will calculate ME values of our feeds. Our common forages, this common forages will hold this point because it's not used for everything, is by multiplying the digestibility value of your feed by 0.16. So if you have a digestibility value of a high quality pasture of 80% digestible, that means for every 1 kilo of dry matter, 800 grams is potentially digestible. Now, to arrive at an ME value for the same sample, all we do, 80 by 0.16, we arrive at a megajoules of ME value of 12.8 megajoules per kilogram of dry matter. And when you think about it, that's pretty straightforward and simple, hey? But acknowledging that's just one lab and different labs will use different equations, and more about that shortly. So for forages such as fresh pasture, other green feeds, so that could be a forage oat, hay, could be silages, could be the green parts of brassica or fodder beet crops. Here in New Zealand, we do tend to base calculations of ME largely or wholly on the digestibility. And I guess we back that proverbial bus back up. How on earth are digestibility measures arrived at for a feed? Well, again, lots of variation here. It depends on the type of your feed and what the lab is able to do for you. Many labs internationally and here in New Zealand also rely heavily on what we call NIRS technology, or near-infrared spectroscopy, which is another topic another day, and maybe we'll invite a clever person in that knows way more about it than I do. But long story short, NIRS just means that you get a feed sample and you dry and grind it, or in some cases you use fresh forage itself. That goes into a machine, and light containing wavelengths, 780 to 2500 nanometers, this NIR spectrum shines onto the ground feed sample, and the different feed components, whether that be protein and whatnot, they bounce off or emit different NIR spectrum that bounces off the feed, which in turn is measured by the spectrophotometer. And then a very clever computer matches up that NIR light spectrum that's bouncing off the feed, and therefore figures out an estimate of what nutrients are in the feed. So that cleverness by the wonderful people that do this work is done by matching up that light spectrum, and they calibrate it against lots and lots and lots of what we call wet chemistry results for their same feed sample. Now, wet chemistry just means the more traditional or non-NIRS ways of defining feed values, for example, digestibility, protein, NDF, starch and water-soluble carbohydrates and the like. So wet chemistry, to remember what it means, it just literally is wet stuff boiling up samples with acids and enzymes. And the wet chemistry gives us much more accurate feed testing values than NIRS. And what the computer does is then match up the NIR spectrum bouncing off feed samples with the wet chemistry results, and that's called building a calibration. Apologies to lab gurus listening, I'm probably not doing a very good job of it, but this just keeps it at the farm level for me to get my head around it. So the very best NIR calibrations are based on hundreds, if not thousands, of wet chemistry samples matched up to the spectrum of light bouncing off all of those same feeds. And the calibration ends up very, very tight, so it can explain up to 99 or 99.8% of the variation. Enough about that, but the reason we love NIRS technology for generating digestibility values is we get a super fast turnaround of results for us overnight, and it's very cheap compared to thousands of dollars with sheep and metabolism crates, etc., to get an absolute megajoule value. So it's obviously, NIRS is obviously not just limited to digestibility. We get a lot of other results. And I think what we might do is invite in a specialist on this area that can talk all about NIRS and wet chemistry in more detail than my very much gumboot farm level value. And the next part of our discussion is to acknowledge some of the limitations of NIRS as a means to give us an estimate of digestibility and therefore the ME. So it's super fast turnaround, very cheap to run compared to animal studies. But there are just a couple of limitations. Now, we defined that calibration that's required between hundreds, if not thousands, of samples that also have the NIRS run on them and they calibrate them. If your calibration is only based on a handful of a small number, 10 or 20 wet chemistry values, then that calibration isn't going to be particularly accurate, and you'll get some pretty weird results that may not truly reflect the feeds that you're poking through there. reputable feed testing labs will have excellent calibrations and will be based on those very high number of samples. And as well, the reputable labs will also continue to refine those calibrations by adding in wet chemistry values into the calibration, particularly if the NIRS generates some oddball results. The lab will take those samples and run wet chemistry on those samples and add them back in just to make sure, particularly at very high or very low values at the end of the calibration curve, might give you some weird results otherwise. Now, the other limitations of NIRS technology, and this is just the practicality, is that no matter what the labs do, some types of feeds simply do not lend themselves well to NIRS technology. And you'll end up with oddball kind of feeds that you're going to have to ask the labs to do wet chemistry for you and not NIRS. So the sorts of feeds we're thinking about might include byproduct feeds from the human food industry, good old palm kernel, PKE, that doesn't lend itself very well to NRS testing. But also things, when we've done feed testing of a lot of our forage crops, things like the bulbs of swedes and fodder beet, for example. Personally, I'd probably prefer to do wet chemistry on those, but enough about that for now. Back on track with ME. Now let's look at some of the really good things about ME as a measure of energy in the feeds that you feed to your animals. And let's have a look at some of the limitations from a practical point of view. Of course, let's look first at the good things about ME as a measure of feed value. Well, we'll start off first with the good thing. And as we've already said with NIRS technology, it's very simple to measure and relatively simple to understand. Which, of course, is good if you're new to this kind of world of understanding feed quality for your sheep or cattle or deer. So, simply put, a high ME value means a feed is more energy dense, and a low ME value simply means that it's less energy dense and therefore less likely to meet the requirements of your ruminant species, whatever you're running on the farm at home. So, in a numbers sense, on the ME scale of very low or poor quality to very high, which is really good quality, the absolute poor quality ME feeds will usually sit around that value of 5, 5.5 to 6. So we don't get ME values of 0 or 1 or 2. The lower scale tends to be, let's say, 5.5 to 6 for something such as wheat or barley straw. So wheat or barley straw obviously is a byproduct of when we head or we harvest wheat or barley for human or animal consumption. And it's just the stem, bit of leaf from that cereal crop. There's very little goodness in it, and that's probably going to sit about 5.5 to 6 ME per kilogram of dry matter. On the top end of a scale, well, it gets a bit messy up the top end. The highest quality feeds from a forage point of view are probably in the mid to high 12s based on feed testing here in New Zealand, but accepting this is a cut point that we're talking about based on the feed testing labs here in New Zealand. We're accepting that compared to us, other labs, for example, in Europe and America, the high values might be lower than 12. So it will depend on the usual values that your lab is testing and reporting. And that's for forages. For other feeds such as cereal grains, we could get into the 13-something ME per kilogram dry matter, particularly for something like maize grain, corn grain, that contains a lot of starch and also quite a decent oil content. For feeds that contain a high oil or fat content, the ME can be considerably higher because, as we talked about under gross energy, the energy density of fats and oils is very, very high. Summing up this section, ME of a feed, it gives you on a scale of low to high. It's much better than simply saying that 1 kilogram of dry matter of a feed is the same as the next, because obviously that can't be, because 1 kilogram dry matter of barley straw is no way the same as 1 kilogram of, for example, maize grain. So ME, or megajoules of metabolizable energy, is a huge step in the right direction compared with comparing feeds on simply kilogram of dry matter to kilogram of dry matter. So if you're new to nutrition, well done you for getting into ME. It's definitely a good step in the right direction, even if you haven't quite yet got your head around crude protein and fibre and the other things. Like, good on you for getting to ME. Another good thing about ME values of feed is that we can run a comparison across different feeds from a cost point of view of those feeds, not only on the basis of cents per kilogram dry matter, but now we can also compare feeds on a cents per megajoule of ME of feed. So let's run an example here. And if in doubt, you can just pause this and get your phone calculator up and get some paper and have a scribble of this just to compare this. And let's have a look at this. If we've got a bale of pasture baleage on a dry matter basis, there may be 250 kilograms of dry matter in that bale. Now, if that bale has cost you $100, what we want to do is generate a cents per kilogram dry matter. And all we need to do is divide 100, it's $100, divided by 250, because there's 250 kilos of dry matter in the bale. Now, that gives us 0.4, which is 40 cents per kilogram of dry matter. So in the world of just dry matter, that's useful to a point. The more dry matter in a bale, which is the wet weight multiplied by the dry matter percent. Again, that's why you want a dry matter percent test your bale along with other things to know how much dry matter is in it. But it's not telling us anything about the quality yet. And of course, all baleage will vary in the ME content of that baleage. So let's say it's 40 cents per kilogram dry matter, and let's say we have two lines of baleage, tube wrap baleage, side by side. They both cost $100 per bale. They both contain 250 kilograms of dry matter, but we now feed test those two lines of baleage. And let's say we find out that the ME of the baleage in the first line was 9.5 ME. Therefore, we take the 40 cents and we divide by 9.5, and that tells us that the value of that baleage is 4.2 cents per megajoule. And then if we look again and the next line of baleage, as I say, also $100 a bale and also containing 250 kilograms of dry matter, but hey, this is better quality, this stuff. The ME of the baleage was 11.2 ME. Again, we'll take 40 cents, divide by 11.2, and instead of that poorer quality baleage that was 4.2 cents per ME, we now, with the better baleage, divide 40 by 11.2 to give us 3.6 cents per ME. So long story short, now by knowing the dry matter present in the bale, which you need a dry matter percent on the feed test to know that, and we know the ME of the baleage, all of a sudden now we've got a much better comparison of these two lines of baleage from a cents per ME basis. Clearly, when you are testing baleage, I'd recommend doing more than just the dry matter percent and the ME, because when we come up to some of the limitations of ME, we still want to look at the other aspects of what is in that bale: protein, fibre, water-soluble carbohydrates, pH, to see how well it's ensiled and all those good things. However, we're on the good things. What's some other good things about ME? Well, the best thing about ME is that we can take reference books, we can take reputable websites that tell us all of the necessary numbers about the ME requirements of animals, nutritional models, and some basic spreadsheets that are available. And here in New Zealand, Beef and Lamb, Deer Hub, and the Facts and Figures with Dairy NZ contain all of the values you're ever going to need to know what the energy requirements of your ruminant animal needs to do its day-to-day ruminant thing. So let's say from Beef and Lamb, we can look at a 30 kilogram lamb may need to be eating, once we've accounted for wastage of feed, it needs to be eating 16 megajoules of ME per day to account for its maintenance requirements, the grazing requirements, and also enough energy to support the growth of 250 grams of live weight per head per day. So we add all that together, gives us 16 ME. That's the daily energy demand for a 30 kilo lamb to graze and grow 250 grams per head per day. Then we can find out what the energy density of the feed that the lamb is eating. So let's say we feed test and say a very good quality pasture contains 12 ME per kilogram of dry matter. And just like that, we now know the kilograms of dry matter that the lamb needs to eat. So in this case, we take the 16 ME required per head per day, we divide it by 12 ME per kilogram of dry matter, and that tells us that that lamb needs to be eating, after allowing for wastage of feed, 1.33 kilograms of dry matter per head per day. And that then feeds in pardon the pun, feeds into your feed budget. You've got 500 lambs and a mob, and they're going into pasture at 1,600 and chewing down to, you know, 1,400, something like that. You can do all of your calculations, and that's the basis that runs in the background, for example, with the FeedSmart model that's set up very, very well on the Beef and Lamb website to run these sorts of calculations for you. Another good thing about ME, just reiterating this point, is, as we said, it's a fast turnaround time because of NIRS technology for the more common feeds. That's some of the good stuff about ME. It's a single number for us to think about. It's a huge step up rather than just comparing feeds on a dry matter basis. And we know that low energy values mean low energy density and therefore relatively poor quality feed. Obviously, ME doesn't account for things like the fact that a low ME feed's probably less palatable, and that will also reduce the intake of the animal. So it doesn't inform us about whether an animal's going to eat a feed or not, so we kind of have to subjectively add that over and above. Limitations? Well, we've already discussed this in that labs around the world, and certainly even labs within the same country, will likely use different methods and calculations to arrive at an ME value for feeds. So we do need to be very careful about comparing the ME values of feeds that have been analysed at different labs. And even sometimes the lab that you routinely use might slightly update the way that they calculate ME, but they'll usually inform you, you know, really well about this with emails and keep you up to date. So it's always just about, if you're going to compare feed quality from year to year, you really want to choose a lab and stick with it and not shop around. Now, another limitation of ME is remembering that it's exactly that. It's a calculated value for energy density, because we don't have the money or time or capacity to run sheep and metabolism crates. So it's not a chemical measure of feed. You know, often it's based on the digestibility value of a feed, but it is a calculated value. It's not an actual chemical measure, as is the case with things like crude protein and acid detergent fibre and starch and the like. Now, the key limitation, and I've already mentioned this, is that ME has a limitation in that it tells us nothing about the other aspects of nutritive value of a feed, such as what I've mentioned a couple of times now, the starch, the water-soluble carbohydrates, the protein, fibre, minerals, etc., vitamins. So if we look only at an ME value of a feed, there's likely to be other aspects of the nutritive value of that feed that might, in some situations, mean that a high ME feed isn't always suitable for all stock classes. Now, one extreme example of this may be you've got a bag sitting in front of you of rumen bypass fat, and quite often these are based on hydrogenated palm oil. Now, the ME of that bag of rumen bypass fat could be as high as 36 or 37 ME per kilogram dry matter. And you go, wow, that's like three times the energy density of the very best quality ryegrass white clover pasture. But of course, we know that ruminants can't tolerate much in the way of fats and oils, even if they are hydrogenated in the case of these bypass products. And for example, a lactating dairy cow, the most of that 36 or 37 ME hydrogenated palm oil product that we can feed is no more than 300 grams. Otherwise, we can start to upset the functionality of the rumen bugs, reduce fibre digestion. That's probably the main one. And it's even worse case if we feed a vegetable oil, such as canola oil. If you put even as much as 100 to 150 mils of canola oil added to a lactating cow's total mixed ration diet, that's enough to reduce fibre digestibility inside the rumen. So on this basis, ME in isolation would suggest fats and oils are wonderful for animals, which they are in very limited amounts, but we need to be very careful because we may have some unintended consequences on the well-being of the microbial population inside the rumen. So when we're looking to increase energy density using fats or oils, you definitely want to get the experienced and qualified ruminant nutritionist involved. But it's just an extreme example of that. So that's the pros and cons of ME as a measure of feed and some of the practicalities at a farm-based level. So I think we'll wrap up now. That's us done and dusted for another of our Rumen Room podcasts. So just summing up what we've just talked about, remembering that ME is just simply a measure of the energy density of the feed for our ruminant species. Also, that the concept of ME is rather simple. high ME feeds are obviously pretty good and for the animals, and if they're foraged, they're obviously going to be more digestible, so less of the energy that the animal is eating is lost out the back end as huge piles of poorly digestible dung in the paddock. And also those higher ME feeds, it's feed to feed dependent, but can potentially lead to reduced methane production per kilogram of dry matter consumed. Specifically, we're talking about starchy cereal grains, will lead to less methane yielded per kilogram of dry matter compared to, for example, a kilogram of a poor quality pasture silage. Also, we touched on the fact that true ME values of feed can only be truly determined by keeping sheep inside metabolism crates and looking at the difference between gross energy being eaten and the gross energy being lost as dung, urinary energy, and as methane as well. Very likely to give you quite an accurate value, but hard work, very expensive and very time consuming. And thankfully, feed testing labs, thanks to amazing feed testing labs that give us calculated estimates of ME that's more quickly to measure and turn around and get results emailed back to us. We talked about the practicalities of ME. It's an awesome step up from comparing feeds simply on a cents per kilogram dry matter basis in the case of our baleage example, but we can then use ME content of feed to calculate the cents per ME basis of purchased and feeds. We also use ME contents of feeds to do feed budgeting. So therefore, we can work out the ME requirements of an animal, divide that by the ME density in feed, and figure out the kilograms of dry matter to run our common feed budgeting models and spreadsheets and the like. Lots of good things about ME, but you know, probably the key weakness for those of you that do enjoy getting into a deeper level of the nutrition of animals is, of course, that it doesn't include and doesn't inform us about the types of fibre, the protein, the water-soluble carbs, starch, the ash content, lignin, minerals and vitamins, but to name a few. So if you are feed testing baleage, for example, and perhaps you've always ticked the box just to look at dry matter percent and ME, here's a challenge. Go for a more detailed feed analysis and then work along someone that can help you interpret the other parts of the feed test. Right, that's us finishing up now. Really hope you found something of interest to ponder about this topic of ME as a measure of feed quality. And we'd encourage you to do more feed testing to really understand how your pastures and forage crops and silage and hay and imported feeds can really drive the performance of your sheep, cattle or deer. But anyway, wrapping up now, this has been Charlotte Westwood. And look, on behalf of both myself and PGG Rights and Seeds, we hope that you have an amazing day out and about, whatever you're up to. Keep up the good work. Cheers.